This is Audible.
This is a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Hi, I'm Harry Nelson, Director of Audio Programs for Franklin Covey. Welcome to this special abridged edition of the best-selling programs, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, Powerful Lessons in Personal Change, and The 8th Habit, From Effectiveness to Greatness, by Dr. Stephen R. Covey. The purpose of this special set is to give you a taste of the key principles and ideas taught by Dr. Covey in his best-selling books, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, with more than 15 million copies sold, and the recently released best-selling book, The 8th Habit. If you like this taste of the habits, may we suggest picking up copies of the books or the newly released full-length, unabridged audio editions. Now here is Dr. Covey.
Foundational Principles.
The essential purpose of the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People is to learn how to lead your life in a truly effective, successful way. Now let me first describe what the 7 Habits material is by describing what it is not. It is not a quick fix program. It is not a program of the month. Rather, it is a process of personal and interpersonal growth and development that will require not only your continuing best efforts, but also your patience. You see, you must pay the price over an extended period of time to fully reap the benefits of these habits. By applying this effort, you can expect to increase your capacity to achieve your personal and professional goals and to develop better working relationships with your associates and all of your loved ones. For our purposes, we will define a habit as the intersection of knowledge, skill, and desire. You see, knowledge is the theoretical component. That is the what to do and the why to do it. Skill is the practical side of how to do it. And desire is the motivation side, the want to do it. In order to make something a true habit in our lives, we literally must have all three components: knowledge, skill, and desire. Now, the 7 habits are simply common sense. That's common sense organized. But remember, what is common sense is not always common practice. So I encourage you to make the investment, to put forth the time and effort, and to focus on the kinds of changes you can make consistently and over time to develop these habits. I think it will help us to visualize the sequential and progressive nature of the 7 habits by seeing a simple little diagram in your mind's eye we could call the maturity continuum. Now, if you were to see a maturity continuum line from low maturity to high maturity, there would be 3 basic levels to it. The first level is dependence. The second, the middle level, is independence. And the third and the highest level is interdependence. Let me define these 3 terms very briefly. Dependence basically means that you need others to get what you want. Dependence is the attitude of you. You take care of me. You come through for me. Or you don't come through for me. Then I blame you for the results. It's very you-oriented. Independence basically means that you are pretty much free of external influence, that is, the control and the support of others. You can get what you want from your own efforts. Independence is the attitude of I can do it. I am responsible. I'm self-reliant. I can choose. The third and highest level in the maturity continuum is interdependence. You see, if people were interdependent, they would think in terms of we, because it's a basic approach of needing other people to accomplish with you what you desire. Again, interdependence is the attitude of we. We can cooperate. We can be a team. We can combine our talents, our abilities, and our best efforts to achieve our highest success. Now here is the basic insight. Think on this for a moment. Until you and I are independent, we cannot be interdependent. Now let me say that again. Until you and I are independent, we cannot be interdependent. In other words, we can't do calculus before we understand algebra. We can't run before we learn to walk. We can neither learn to work cooperatively with another person if we don't have internal self-mastery, true independence. That's why the first three habits, be proactive, begin with the end in mind, and put first things first, deal with self-mastery, self-control, and self-dominion. They form the deepest part of our character. They constitute what I call the private victory. That is, the victory over self. These first three habits lead us from dependence to independence. Then once people have control over themselves, I don't mean an absolutely perfect control, but a high measure of independence, they are ready to deal with the next three habits, which we call think win-win. Seek first to understand, then to be understood, and synergize. And all of these help us in our relationships with others, enabling us to be successful with them. Thus, these habits, 4, 5, and 6, develop what I call the public victory, that is, effectiveness with others. The public victory is based on teamwork, on cooperation, on communication. In fact, on creative cooperation based on communication. Habits 4, 5, and 6 utilize our personality, and they are more skill-based. These public victory habits lead us from independence to interdependence. That is, the attitude of we. We work together. We create together to accomplish common desired results. Habit 7, sharpen the saw, is the habit of continuous improvement that creates an upward spiral of growth and development. And then we begin to discover the underlying 6 habits in entirely new ways, and we achieve entirely new levels of performance with each of those habits. For a moment, let's think now what the real nucleus of each of these habits is. It is a principle. Let's think about what that means, principle. You see, a principle is the actual reality, like the law of gravity, of the way things are. For instance, how many of you, when you were in school, did a lot of cramming? Think about it. Be honest with yourself. Did you get good at it? Now, have you ever worked on a farm? Did you ever cram on the farm? I don't mean just work hard at the end to bring in the harvest. I mean to forget to plant in the spring, to flake off all summer, and then to really hit it hard in the fall to bring in the harvest. Well, of course, that's patently foolish. And we know why. Because a farm is a natural system. It is governed by principles. You see, principles are natural laws. Now, this is an extremely important idea. And this idea lies at the very heart of each of these habits. You can't really fake these habits. You have to pay the price. You can't fake any true growth and development. We're dealing with principles, with realities. You see, in a sense, we are not in control. Often the popular social language is get in control. You are the master of your own destiny. When in fact we are not in control. Principles control. Now if we accept that and follow these principles, then in that sense we are in control. In that sense we are the master of our destiny. But that is a humility sense because it respects that principles ultimately govern, not social values. We control our actions, but the consequences that flow from those actions are controlled by principles. As Abraham Lincoln once put it, people will pass away, but principles never will. Principles live on forever. This is why we believe so much in the Eastern statement, give a man a fish and you feed him for the day. Teach him how to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. See, even though you may teach someone a practice, something to do, always try to teach the principle which underlies that practice, that action. Because you see, the situation may change, and the practice may no longer apply, but the principle will remain constant. It will always apply. You see, principles are universal. They are natural laws. They are also self-evident, self-validating. They are changeless. They ultimately govern. Values don't govern. Principles ultimately govern. The key is to align our values, our habits, our behavior with principles. And when they are so aligned, you could almost use the words values and principles interchangeably. Now I'd like to introduce you to another key word, paradigm. Paradigm is a scientific term. Simply, it means a mental image that you have in your mind of the way things are out there. These are the images we carry in our head of reality. And these images come from our backgrounds, our own experiences. They represent the implicit assumptions of our lives. See, all of us think we see the world as it is, but in reality, we see the world as we are. We project out of our own conditioning experiences our background, a certain representation, a certain model, a certain set of expectations, a certain assumption on what reality is out there. And we think that's the way it is. I might describe myself, I might describe you, I might describe a situation as if I were describing it as it is. In fact, I am describing myself, that is, my perceptions of you and me and situations. It's my frame of reference, my worldview, my value system, my autobiography. In other words, I am describing myself and then projecting it upon the outside. For instance, as soon as you became a father or a mother, did you not see the world differently? I mean entirely differently. When you changed your name and your role to manager for the first time, did you not see the world differently? You see, that's a new paradigm, a new map. When you became a leader, did you not see the world differently? You see, your role has changed. You see the world differently. The quickest way to change a person's behavior is to change their paradigm. That is, how they define themselves, how they see their role, even perhaps to change their name. Don't work on their behavior. Don't work on their attitude. Just change how they see their role, how they see their responsibility, their stewardship. Okay, we've talked a little about the concept of a principle and the concept of a paradigm. Now let's define what we mean by effectiveness. You see, we're talking about the seven habits of highly effective people. Not mediocre effectiveness. We're talking about high level effectiveness. That is, quantum leaps in effectiveness. Now, what do we mean by effectiveness? We could use the word success, you know, but that word carries so much of the old social value connotation of having it all. That's why we use the word effectiveness. We want to create a new image, a new sense of what that means, because we're talking about seven habits of highly effective people. To define this, let's think about Aesop and his famous tales, particularly about the one of a poor farmer that is just down on his luck. Everything is falling apart, yet the farmer visits his favorite goose and he notices one day there is a large egg, a golden egg, by the side of that goose. To his total amazement and delight, he discovered that the egg is pure gold, and he's been so poor for so long. The next day, he finds another one, and the next day, another one. Every day, there's another golden egg, and he becomes wealthy, fabulously wealthy, but he also becomes very impatient and very greedy. He wants them all, and he wants them now. So he kills the goose, he reaches inside to get all of the golden eggs, and of course, finds none. Now, in that little fable, is the essence of the definition of effectiveness. Effectiveness is made up basically of two things. First, getting what you want. And second, getting what you want in a way that enables you to get what you want again and again and again. We call it PPC balance. P stands for production of desired results, you know, the golden eggs, and PC stands for production capability. That means the health and welfare of the goose. In other words, the capacity of the asset to continue to produce the results, or the capacity of the goose to continue to produce golden eggs. Now, you can apply this idea of balance between production and production capability to any field of human endeavor. How many of you have had, say, a PPC imbalance with regard to the way you take care of your physical assets? Your car? Your lawnmower? Ever neglected one of these? It takes time and attention and money to attend to production capability, to PC. But sometimes when we're in a rush and we want what we want now, we just go ahead and run that machine or that car with no thought to its maintenance. No production capability attention at all. Eventually, no more golden eggs. The goose dies. Well, what about our bodies? How many of you have the regular practice of a good exercise program? How many know that you should? We all do. Well, ultimately, what will happen if we neglect our exercise or this production capability with our body? Well, all kinds of negative things happen. As we know, the immune system gets weakened sometimes, and it makes us vulnerable to all kinds of other diseases. What about the mind? What about the development of the mind? It takes constant learning, or we can become so obsolete so fast that if we don't pay the price on a daily basis to stay abreast of our fields, we will suffer in every way. It's estimated that most professions have the half-life of about 4 years. So you can see that effectiveness with oneself, with body, mind, even with one's spirit, is a PPC balance. This is the essence of effectiveness. The same thing applies to relationships. Take a marriage relationship. You may have a situation like I saw a while back, a very successful person. He went from nothing to being worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Yet he had a totally bankrupt family. And the question's asked, was this person truly successful? To use our language, effective. Well, in the business sense, maybe you'd say yes. But in the total sense, in terms of what really matters on one's deathbed, you'd probably say no. Production capability was utterly neglected in his marriage and family. Can you see why effectiveness at home requires this PPC balance?
Habit 1. Be proactive.
Now let us begin with the foundational habit, Habit 1. Be proactive. Habit 1, be proactive, basically means that your life is a product of your values, not your feelings. Again, that your life is a product of your values, not your feelings. Your life is a product of your decisions, not your conditions. To be proactive means you take the initiative to do whatever's necessary to make good things happen. In other words, you're the creative force of your own life. To use the computer metaphor, habit one is the awareness that you are the programmer. It is the budding awareness that the best way to predict your future is to create it. The opposite of being proactive is to be reactive, which basically means that your life is a function of your feelings, your moods, your impulses, or how other people treat you, such as taking out your anger on work associates or loved ones at home because you feel so frustrated. You feel victimized. You feel like you're under the control of other forces. Other people are doing it to you. They're doing you in. So you feel you have ample justification and reason to essentially say, I am what other people have made of me. I am what my past has made of me. I am what is happening to me from all around today. See, and then not to take responsibility. Habit one is the habit of awareness that I am a separate person from all that has happened to me, including all of my feelings, my moods, even my genetic makeup, and so forth. The underlying principle of Habit 1, Be Proactive, is to take responsibility. The concept is, you and I have the capacity to choose our response. I am responsible. I am response-able. But see, it's much easier to say, I am not responsible, than to say, I'm irresponsible. Again, let's define Habit 1, Be Proactive, as the capacity to subordinate impulses, words, feelings, conditions to values based on principles. You know, we're tested every day in many little ways in the ordinary things in our life. And if we are proactive in those things, it gradually develops extraordinary capability in handling major setbacks or disappointments. We learn that we have the power to choose our attitude. We have the power to choose our own response in any given set of circumstances we can do nothing about. In other words, between what happens to us, the stimulus, and our response to the stimulus is a space. In that space lies our freedom and power to choose our response. And in those choices lie our growth and our happiness. I'd now like to teach another idea that to me is so exciting about this idea of proactivity. Imagine, if you will, two circles. One, a larger outer circle we call the circle of concern. And the second, a smaller inner circle we call the circle of influence. The circle of influence basically means those are things you can do something about. You can have influence upon them or control over them, such as your health, your family, your work. The circle of concern, the outer circle, represents things you can do nothing about, such as the weather, international events, the force of nature, and so forth. Where does the proactive person focus? The inner circle. And what do you think happens to this inner circle? It gets larger and larger. And you're more and more able to influence. But where does the reactive person focus? On the outer circle. That is the circle of concern. Things outside themselves of which they feel they have no control or influence at all. This circle of influence idea is tremendous because you can use it to motivate yourself by it and to say, no matter what the circumstances are, I'm going to be proactive and give my energies to the inner circle, to those things I can really do something about. And if you're patient and persistent, it will get larger.
Habit 2. Begin with the end in mind.
Now as we go into Habit 2, begin with the end in mind, let me first try to put it in perspective with Habit 1. To use the computer metaphor again, Habit 1 basically says you are the programmer. Habit 2, begin with the end in mind, says write the program. You see, if you're the programmer, then write it. Don't just live some other program out that you don't feel meets your needs and your values. You decide it. You write it. Look at it this way for a moment. Habit 1 is the habit of personal vision. That is, you have a vision or a personal sense that you have this internal power to choose your response, and that you can choose it on the basis of values. But notice that assumes values. That assumes a self-chosen value system. That's what Habit 2 is. Habit 2 is the habit of personal leadership. It's based upon that vision, but it's the program that you write for yourself. You take leadership in your own life, in your family life, in your work life. Leadership deals with the direction of one's life. You decide your value system. Habit 2 is based on the principle of personal leadership, of purpose, of mental creation, and of mission. The opposite of Habit 2 is to do no intellectual creation, to have no sense of mission, to do no envisioning of the future, to just kind of let life happen, to go with the flow with no particular focus, to begin with no particular objective in mind. So the second habit, to begin with the end in mind, is in a sense the test of our meaning. What is our life about? What is our identity? It is not to abandon ourselves and to live out the programs that others have given to us and then blame them for how poor those programs were. An interesting thing about life is that it is always created twice. Always. You see, the first creation is an intellectual creation. The first creation is of the mind and of the spirit. The second creation is a physical creation. The home or office or car that you're in right now was mentally created in every detail, and the plan reduced to a blueprint before it was actually physically created. The carpenter's rule is, measure twice, cut once. In other words, you've got to make sure the blueprint, the first creation, is really what you want, and that you've thought through everything. To begin with the end in mind is the most important decision, and the most significant decision. Why? Because every other decision, large and small, will be influenced by that decision. What are the principles I want to operate my life on? What are the principles we want our family to operate on? What are the principles we want our organization to operate on? You see, you're deciding what are the things that are truly important. This is a very fundamental principle, so that you have a continuing sense of guidance in your life. Then you don't end up climbing that proverbial ladder that is leaning against the wrong wall. I suggest that the highest essence of Habit 2, to begin with the end in mind, is the development of a personal mission statement, a personal purpose statement, whatever you want to call it, and also the development of a family mission statement. I seriously think that is the most important activity of Habit 2. Likewise, I would encourage organizations to develop a mission statement for the entire organization, for a department, for a team, for a board, for a committee. I think it should contain two basic parts: vision and principles. Vision deals with the mental picture of what you are about, and principles deal with how you go about it. In organizations, we ask, what is this organization about? What is its essential purpose or mission? Then we also ask, what does it value that represents its changeless core? See, those are the two parts: vision and principle-centered values. This is profound, deep work. You have to really work to get perspective, though. It takes time. You have to be patient. We should give ourselves several months, at least weeks. We must pay a price as we cultivate this sense of vision, this purpose. Remember also that vision is different than principles. Vision is different than values. Vision requires an enormous amount of self-awareness, and of imagination, and of humility, of openness, and also of the use of conscience. As Viktor Frankl put it, the thing I learned is that you don't invent your mission. You detect it. You uncover it, as it were. Everyone has special gifts and unique qualities and characteristics, and they need to work until, in a sense, they inwardly detect it. What are your unique gifts? Use self-knowledge. Take time. Listen within. And listen also to those who see the potential in you. Sense their affirmation of you. Study the lives of people who have inspired you. What is it you so admired about them? So that little by little you can get a sense of what principles you yourself want to build upon. Then think about what contributions are important to you, and what growth and development is essential to make those contributions. A good mission statement is that it should either implicitly or explicitly deal with all of the roles of your life. You don't want to neglect any one of your roles. In my personal life, I have the role of being a husband, a father. I have the role of being a manager. I have the role of being a teacher, of being a writer. I have the role of being a community worker, a neighbor, a church worker, and all of these roles are important to me. We need to lead a balanced life. And to lead a balanced life, we need to think through all those roles and in some way include them in our mission statements. But let me share with you three no-nos about developing mission statements I've learned from observation, from sad experience. First, don't rush them. Don't be into efficiency. Second, don't announce them or try to install them. Always invite deep involvement and deep participation from everyone in the family or the organization. Third, don't ignore them. In other words, act upon them. You put your mission statement where it can be examined and explored, and where you can go and study it against your behavior to see how well you're living up to it and what you need to do to improve. To sum up, I would make certain that my own personal mission statement is intact first. Then I would work on developing a family mission statement. If my family is just my spouse, I would work on developing it with my spouse, so that we had our own mature way of how to deal with problems and how to nurture our own immune system so that we could handle any problems that may come along. So I commend to you the process of long-term thinking, long-term planning, long-term envisioning, so that you gradually build very powerful personal and family and organizational mission statements that surround the accomplishment of worthy purposes. To me, that is the essence of true leadership.
Habit 3. Put first things first.
Now let's quickly review. Habit 1, be proactive, is the awareness that you are the programmer. Habit 2, begin with the end in mind, is where you write the program. Habit 3 is where you run it. In other words, you execute around it. The third habit is to put first things first. The opposite of habit 3, to put first things first, is to put second or third things first. Or to put first things second. In a sense, you become bogged down in what is called the thick of thin things. Goethe said it this way, "Things which matter most must never be at the mercy of things which matter least." Now, habit 3, put first things first, is the test of our integrity. Can we walk by those first things? You see, in a very real sense, the second habit, begin with the end in mind, decides what the first things are. And the third habit, put first things first, is that habit of our discipline and our commitment to live by those first things. Thus, it is the habit of integrity, the habit of keeping our lives integrated. In other words, we walk our talk. That's the real challenge and the true test of our integrity and our maturity. Habit 3 would be the management principle of putting first things first, where habit 2 is the leadership principle in deciding what the first things are. In other words, in habit 3, you organize and execute around the priorities you decided on in habit 2. Now, essentially, habit 3, to put first things first, is the paradigm or way of thinking which focuses upon relationships rather than schedules. Why? Because people in relationships are the first things. And almost all people will come to that. The traditional paradigm or way of thinking in the field of time management has always dealt with time, with scheduling, with control, with efficiency. That is, doing more things faster. You see, that paradigm is focused on efficiency and control. It is called time management. You manage your time. The clock is its symbol. It drives us toward efficiency. Have you ever tried to be efficient with a loved one on a tough issue? How did it go? You ever do it with your spouse? How did it go? You ever do it with a difficult teenage situation? How did that one go? You see, right off the bat, you already know how foolish it is. But look at the paradigm that drives it. When it doesn't work, what do? We try to do it better. We try to do it more efficiently, more quickly. Now, the paradigm I'm trying to teach is symbolized by a compass, not a clock. And it is based upon a sense of focusing upon the first things in our lives. And they're always relationships. This is also true in business. Relationships with customers, associates, and so forth. And the essence of all effectiveness basically deals with people and with relationships. And ultimately, these are governed by a moral sense of principles, that is, of what is right and what is wrong, and of integrity around those principles. This requires all of us to be sufficiently open and humble to just get into this kind of pair of glasses, this new frame of reference, this new paradigm, this new map that is based upon relationships, not schedules, based upon principles, not values, based upon leadership first, then management, based upon a compass, and then a clock. A good practical way of doing this is to write down on a piece of paper what to you are the most important things, the first things in your life, the supremely important things. Now, we're speaking of things in a generic sense, such as people, relationships, family, health, integrity, service, and so forth. What are your first things? Just list 5 or 6. This takes real deep thinking because you have to prioritize. In fact, you may wish to even pause this program momentarily while you do this little exercise. Now think of one activity in your work or professional life that you know that if you did it superbly well and consistently, would produce marvelous results. In other words, think of activities in your personal and your work life that help us to secure the first things you've already identified. Now that you've written down what the first things are, and you've written down what is the one activity in your personal and in your work life that you absolutely know that if you did it superbly well, you would produce marvelous results, study that. Most of you put down in your first things your family, your loved ones. I know you did. I've done this all over the world, and that's what most people put down. You'll also find that you also wrote down about the same activities that would produce marvelous results. You'd focus on preparation, on prevention, on value clarification, on planning, on relationship building, on deep communication with the key people in your lives. You may have used different words, but the underlying meanings are almost always the same, everywhere. The point that we're trying to get across here is that we shift to this new paradigm, which is a way of thinking based upon principles and relationships, rather than things and schedules. In other words, based on leadership first, then management. Based on relationships first, then schedules. Based upon a compass, then a clock. Now, if you'll take out the little guide that came with the program, you'll see a chart in there showing 4 quadrants I call the time management matrix. The key words to understand are importance and urgency. Importance basically comes from within you. Importance is your value system, hopefully based on principles. Importance is your mission, your central strategy to accomplish those high priority goals and the plans to implement that strategy. Urgency comes from the environment. It presses upon you. It's proximate. It's right in front of you. And it's often very popular. It could be deep into a social value system. It's urgent. It has the appearance of requiring immediate attention. Now you have to decide what is truly important in your life. That's why I asked you. Now notice the question. What are the most important things to you, your first things? And then I asked, what are the single activities that you know without any question that by doing those consistently, superbly well, you'd accomplish marvelous results? See, you've identified what's important. Now, quadrant 1, you'll notice, is both urgent and important. These are usually called problems or crises, putting out fires. Sometimes these quadrant 1 activities are deadline-driven. So it's either a present problem or a problem in the making if you neglect it. Quadrant 2 is not urgent, but it is important. Prevention is not urgent. But is that important? Very important? Critically important? Absolutely. So quadrant 2 would include prevention, as well as preparation, planning, relationship building, empowerment, self-development, developing mission statements, and the like. You see, quadrant 2 is the leadership quadrant. Now, quadrant 3 is not important, but it is urgent. It includes many proximate pressing matters and many popular activities, interruptions, other people's expectations. So all these quadrant 3 activities are not important, but they have the appearance of urgency. Finally, quadrant 4 is neither urgent or important. This usually includes irrelevant phone calls and mail, busy work, time wasters such as excessive TV, and so, again, quadrant 4 is neither urgent nor important. All right, now, looking at your paper and looking at your answers to those 2 questions, what quadrant were those answers in? What would you say? It had to be either 1 or 2, but why is almost every answer in 2? Because you're not doing them. And why? Because they're not urgent. The whole popular culture has so defined urgency as important that we end up neglecting that which is important but not urgent. Relationship building, deep communication with the key people at home and at work, planning, preparation, getting a clear sense of mission or priorities, etc. In fact, you examine most executive agendas, most agendas of any meeting, against the four quadrants, and you'll find almost all of them are quadrants 1 and 3. Quadrant 2 is usually called other business. And what happens to it? It gets pushed aside by quadrants 1 and 3. So where do you get time for quadrant 2 when you're inundated by quadrant 1 things that are both important and urgent? You neglect quadrants 3 and 4. You literally, smilingly neglect them. Those things which are not important, you literally say no. Because things which matter most must never be at the mercy of things which matter least. You'll have the power to do this quadrant 2 work, when there is a burning yes inside you about your mission and purpose and value system. You can literally say no to all kinds of unimportant, however urgent other things may be. A phone call comes up. Could you come to this business meeting? I would like to, however, I have a prior commitment. Even if that commitment is to yourself for planning or preparing or preventing. When people sense your quadrant 2 orientation, they'll begin to see you differently.
Habit 4. Think win-win.
Habit 4, think win-win, lies at the very heart of all relationships. Think win-win is the habit of mutual benefit. It is the habit of the golden rule. It is the habit of abundance. The underlying principle is abundance. In other words, there's plenty out there and to spare. So you don't have to be threatened by the strengths of other people. You can nurture competency around you higher than your own. It doesn't threaten you. You can share knowledge. You can share recognition. You can share gain and profit. Why? Because of abundance. Most people have never had profound experiences with win-win people. They don't really believe there's such a thing as win-win. It's either you win or you lose. You're either tough or you're soft. You're strong or you're weak. They think in dichotomies, either or. And they'll become martyrs. They'll go for lose-win and call it win-win, particularly among so-called important people. And then they'll often take out their energy on the ones that they can control, so that they're lose-win above them and win-lose below them. Then what happens at the side all depends on the moods and the ego of the people involved. Who's winning in your marriage? And what happens when your kids take you on? Do you take them on back? What about your employees? Who's winning there? Oftentimes, win-lose can become so vindictive, so acrimonious, that people literally are drenched in ego. And they don't even care if they lose as long as the other person loses. In fact, I remember a situation where a divorcee was just into such a win-lose spirit that he was told by the judge that he was to take half of his assets and sell them and give the other half to his ex-wife. So he took an $8,000 car, sold it for $50 so he could give her $25. You see, the win for him was twist that thing, see, make them pay. Some people almost temporarily buy so deeply into win-lose. And if both do, and they're drenched in ego, lose-lose inevitably results. In fact, in my opinion, in the long run, any win-lose approach or lose-win approach on essential jugular issues in the long run eventually will be useless and end up in lose-lose. Remember, principles ultimately will govern. So that if there's a spirit of acrimoniousness, a spirit of vindictiveness, a spirit of getting back, of getting even, it becomes a very deep violation with the universal principle of equity, of fairness, and of the golden rule. Can you begin to see that the roots of the win-win mindset comes deep out of the private victory of habits 1, 2, and 3? You see, if the private victory is real and sincere, you're at peace. You're centered, you're anchored, you're rooted, you're established, Your ego's not involved. Down deep, you're invulnerable. So you can afford to be vulnerable on the surface of your life and go for win-win. So habit four, to think win-win, comes from the principle of abundance, not scarcity. Meaning that the pie gets larger and larger and larger. In what way? Because through the interaction on a win-win basis, a transformation begins to take place in our natures to where we tap into more creativity, more resourcefulness, more ingenuity, more wisdom, more intelligence, deeper and deeper into the bowels of the organization. We see the problem differently. We define it differently. We come up with new alternatives that do tap into abundance instead of the one we've been considering that only was based upon scarcity. So that deeper in our marriage, deeper in our family life and in our organizations, this kind of win-win spirit can eventually bring about synergy. So that ultimately the whole is truly greater than the sum of the parts. We'll talk about this under Habit 6 later. Such an abundance mentality increases knowledge, increases power, and the earlier fears become unfounded. So to summarize the essence of Habit 4, think win-win, it basically means that you try to cultivate, in your own nature and character, an abundance spirit. And then in the relationship with another person, you're always pursuing mutual benefit, so that both parties win. And then you try to create an environment surrounding that which nurtures the keeping of that relationship on a win-win basis. Win-win is a paradigm. It is a way of thinking about all relationships. Sometimes you may need to go for no deal, but realize in the long run, anything but win-win will ultimately result in lose-lose.
Habit 5. Seek first to understand, then to be understood.
The whole key in Habit 5 is the sequence between these two expressions. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. Most people literally do the very opposite. In fact, notice your own tendencies. Do you want to be understood before you seek to understand? The tendency of most all people is to listen with the intent to reply, not with the intent to understand. That's the most common tendency in us all. In most conversations, most interactions, the only desire is to be understood. Why? That's part of the need to be loved. We talked about to live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy. Love truly makes the world go round. To feel understood is to feel loved. And people have a need to be loved. However, the whole key to human influence is first to be influenced. Now, what does that mean? The key to having influence on another person is that they feel that they have had influence with you. That is, that you were open to them, to what they were saying and feeling, and that you were consequently influenced by them. In other words, you understood them. The key to human influence with our spouses, with our children, with our work associates, in fact, with anyone, is always first to understand. That's the first point I'm trying to make here under Habit 5. This is so important because our tendencies run in an absolute opposite direction. Because everyone lives in their own world. It's a subjective world. It's a world that has its own meanings in it. Everyone has their own perceptions of what reality is. And people are walking around in these subjective worlds, and then they collide with each other. And when they have to interact with each other, they usually interact efficiently within their own world. But if they're trying to bring the worlds together to create a better world, or to come up with a new agreement or a new arrangement, of necessity, both worlds come together. And unless we seek to understand the other person's world, we will not have influence with that other person, nor they with us. Let me use a couple of physical illustrations to illustrate. Could you possibly prescribe glasses for eyes you haven't diagnosed? No, if you're wearing glasses, it's because the optometrist first sought to understand and then build the prescription on that understanding. Another illustration. If you were to take the air out of the room you're in or the car you're in right now, what would happen to your interest in listening to this audio teaching program? All of a sudden, you have this great sucking sound and there's no air. What would you do? It wouldn't make any difference how interesting or how fascinating this program happened to be to you. You would want air. You'd do whatever you could do to get air. But now you get it. Now that you have air, does air motivate you? No. Your interest shifts to learning. Why? A satisfied need no longer motivates. You know what the equivalent is emotionally to air? It's to feel understood. They are then open to understand you. They're open to be influenced. But until they feel understood, nothing else you do will work with them. Because inside they'll always say, he or she does not understand. When you understand another, you've accepted them. That doesn't mean you agree with them, but that you accept they are people of worth, people worth listening to. You value them, or you wouldn't have spent such time understanding them. You also accept that they see their world differently. You accept that they live in their own world and that it has legitimacy. They occupy space. They are part of the human race. See, essentially, that's air. The most basic elemental foundation of it is that you matter to me. I accept you. Why? I understand you. Why would I want to understand you if you didn't matter, if you didn't have legitimacy? You see, to love another person is to affirm them emotionally, physically, to shake their hand, to empathize with them in some way. They need to be fed this air, this human touch, this warmth, this deep communication, and it can come in many, many ways. The problem is that most of us tend to get into a very efficient state of mind. We have our own schedule. We know the kinds of things we want to accomplish. We think it through in our mind. We're under a lot of pressure. There are all kinds of things on our platter, and it's tough. And that's the way modern life is. It's a rushing, fast-moving world. It's changing. It's chaotic. It's turbulent. Well, what do we do to handle that? You have to kind of figure it out. You have to try to be efficient and schedule yourself and then carry out your schedule. But see, the problem is that when you get into an efficient state of mind, you also try to be efficient in your listening as well. And you don't really take time to listen to understand, to listen empathically, meaning to listen within the other's frame of reference. I know for myself, if I were to fault me at the highest point on these habits, it would be on trying to be efficient with people. When you're dealing with another person and they're living out of their own world and they want you involved in their world, it just slows down your world. In other words, we really have to get into a whole different frame of mind and attach ourselves to the higher values of what's really important and to ask, is this little time thing, this efficiency need, that important? Really, did anyone on their deathbed ever wish they'd spent more time at the office? I'll tell you what they talk about. They talk about what's important, and that's relationships. With people, you can't be efficient. Remember again, fast is slow with people, and slow is fast. So to seek first to understand, then to be understood, requires emotional strength. It requires patience, openness, and a desire to understand, all highly developed qualities of character. It also takes a lot of time. It really does. It's not just a quality of time, it's quantity. And the one cannot compensate for the other. But in the long run, it saves so much time. My guess is for every hour spent in correct understanding, it saves 10 to 50 to 100 hours in dealing with the problems that came from not understanding. Oh, if people only knew how much time they would save later on and what a beautiful relationship they're losing out on by not taking the time initially to truly seek to understand another. Because in some ways it's very, very hard to catch up later. But it can still be done, and I would not become discouraged.
Habit 6. Synergize. Habit 6. Synergize, in a sense, is the fruit of the spirit of Habit 4, Think Win-Win, and the spirit of Habit 5, Seek First to Understand, Then to Be Understood. See, when 4 and 5 are in place, what happens is a very unique and powerful thing. People are beginning to interact together genuinely. They're open to each other's influence, and new insights emerge. A new dynamic is born. Something happens to them both, and it happens between them. It creates the possibility of third alternatives. It's not an either-or approach. It's not win-lose or lose-win, and it's not a compromise.
Compromise is where 1 plus 1 equals 1 and a half. But synergy is where 1 plus 1 equals 3, 4, 10, 50. There's also a negative form of synergy where 1 plus 1 equals, say, 1 half. In other words, so much of the effort and energy is spent in adversarialism, in conflict, in defensive and protective communication, that it literally wastes the energy of the people, of the enterprise, of the marriage, of the family. And you end up with less than what one person could do, himself or herself. Anyone who has experienced sustained conflict and contention, they know what little productivity comes out. So just remember these definitions. Synergy is where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. In other words, it's the part between the parts that is the key part. Synergy means you can literally produce something that neither of you could have produced before, or even adding what each can produce separately. It's like having two ears. They're connected with the brain, and you end up where you can sense direction, where if you had two ears unconnected, you'd have no sense of direction. One plus one literally equals three or more. Now, if you have one plus one equaling two, that's not synergy. That might be transaction. You go in and you buy gas and you give money. You transacted. That's not synergistic. You may have cooperated. That's not synergistic. Synergy is creative cooperation, where 1 plus 1 equals 3, 4, or 10. Negative synergy, as I mentioned, is where there is enough internal contention and adversarialism that it produces less than even what one person can produce on their own, because so much of the energy is wasted going in the wrong direction. In other words, it's counterproductive. Now, the traditional paradigm of interaction, particularly when there are differences and disagreements, is to go for compromise. That's literally where most people think we end up realistically. And most people think that that's where we should go. That's what synergy means. Not so. That's realistic, however, if you're in a low-trust culture. But if you can cultivate the emotional bank account and the trust goes up, you don't need to go for compromise. The key to habit six, synergize, you could almost say is to value differences. It's not something you just tolerate that there are differences, or that you just accept that there are differences. It's not something that is legislated through diversity programs to respect differences. But really, deeply, you actually celebrate differences. You realize that in the differences lies this very special creative dynamic. And that if we can demonstrate this mutual understanding, it will unleash this dynamic so that really strength lies in differences. As long as there is a common vision and principle-centered value system, then those differences become creative and productive. However, if there is not a common purpose, a common vision, a common set of principle-centered values, as well as a deep buy-in to that, then diversity, differences, will literally result in chaos and negative synergy, and it will spawn further prejudice and prejudgment. In other words, it becomes fundamentally counterproductive. That's why it requires the integrity of the first three habits, the development of a common purpose, a common sense of meaning, a common sense of mission, and sufficient integrity around those values that were identified, that the security goes within people so they can afford the risks of thinking win-win, of having the patience and the self-control to seek first to understand and to really be open to understanding. Then gradually you see this dynamic, magical thing happening of inventing a new spirit, inventing new approaches, third alternatives, and they are exponentially increased because of these differences. So strength literally lies in these differences. These aren't just nice words to value diversity, to value differences. These are moral imperatives for those that really want to solve problems in entirely new ways. In fact, to get new understanding of the nature of the problems themselves. Go for synergy. The moment someone disagrees with you, train yourself to say to them, or within yourself, good, you see it differently. I want to understand. Help me understand. You come from an entirely different angle. You're intelligent. You care. I want to understand. You see the spirit of that? But if you're just into independence and into efficiency and self-control and control of others, you won't feel to say, good, I'm glad there are differences. You'll end up wanting to tell them what to think, what to feel, what to do, and you'll end up turning people into things. But then that violates the relationship and you don't get synergy.